Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 31 of Here We Go Again, Israeli Politics. Terrible terrorist attack claims the life of yeshiva student and injures two others. The terrorists are still at large. Authoritarian mandates for the police in Corona. Yom Hash elections. Chief Rabbinate fights with the Minister of Religion. And abortion update. This is Here We Go Again. Okay, for our first topic.
Our first topic this week is a very sad one. There was a terrorist attack that took place Thursday where one Jewish resident was killed and two were seriously injured. The Jewish resident who was a student in the yeshiva of Chomish was killed was Yehuda Dimentman. The terrorist attack that took place was the terrorists had an ambush ready for their car as they drove out and opened fire on the car as it passed. Once again, killing Yehuda and injuring two others. Obviously, a terrible event. I mean, heart goes out to the families of these residents. Also, sadly, the terrorists got away, and there's still a manhunt going on for the terrorists who committed these horrendous acts. Now, there's a few things that we have to look at here. First, sadly, this is not a new thing that has happened, nor is it a uncommon event recently. We have seen a very large uptick in the amount of terrorist attacks. Even those that are making it to the news, which is a serious minority of terrorist attacks, we've seen a very large uptick, and it's a very serious issue that this administration is going to have to start to deal with soon. As to dealing and curbing the violence in this area. And this is before we get to any of the political ramifications. Just on basic practical side of the numbers, we've seen a rise in recent years in general. 2019 was higher than the year before, 2020 was higher than the year before it, and 2021 was higher than 2020. Number of terrorist attacks has grown exponentially in the past few years, and it is a very, very serious issue that needs to deal with. Now, on to the more political side of things. We have to mention a story that happened earlier in the week. The Minister for Interior Defense, Omer Bar-Lev, went to the United States this week and met with one of the undersecretaries of defense. And he posted a tweet claiming that he met with the Undersecretary of Defense and he discussed the violence of the settlers and how to curb it and to keep peace in the area. Now, this caused a very serious uproar because, as is very well known to anyone who has spent time in Israel and anyone who hopes the claims to be of moderate left to the right, knows that these two acts are not comparable. Terrorist attacks and all of the different actions that are taken is not a comparable action to the violence of the settlers, which, albeit terrible, is not numerically even comparable to an amount that happens, a very rare occurrence that usually does not cost in lives and does not have nearly the same effect. This has been a very big issue that has been in the forefront of this government since the beginning. There are different views on these matters. Even when Bennett formed this government, when he claimed that that Bar-Lev and Kahana, who is the Minister of Religion, both served together in the war in Lebanon, why can't they be together in the same government? Well, they can't be together because their ideologies are so vastly different and so contradictory to one another, they cannot function together. As an excuse, once the massive backlash came from both the left and the right, the opposition and the coalition, to his comments, he stated that obviously both issues are major issues. Both issues he was referring here to Palestinians and to settlers, but there's only so many letters in a tweet you can put up. This, once again, was not an excuse, and this is just hard action where he once again seems to blame the settlers for everything going on, where both options have no comparison, should not have any comparison in the public. The main point of this was people took a look at Bennett and said, you cannot be leading us as the prime minister if your main job, which is to keep the ministers in line, you are not functioning at. Even if you put out a nice tweet condemning his words or giving your support to the settlers, I want to remind everyone that Naftali Bennett has not once visited anywhere over the Green Line since him coming to him. And he needs to have a serious action taken against Omer Bar-Lev, more than simply stating a few words about against it in Twitter, be it asking for his resignation and official condemnation. There are actions to be taken that needed to be taken in this manner that were not taken. It's a very problematic thing when you look at it just for the simple facts of the weakness shown here and the precedent sent where they could all just step over him, especially on such an issue which is fundamental, the ideology of many of the members of this government and their voters and just the citizens of Israel in general. The basic tenet of any government, their most basic mandate, is to protect their citizens. And if what's more important to you is your view in the world of violence and not the safety of your citizens from terrorist attacks, that's a serious issue. But multiple things can be true at once. And we must be fair to Omer Bar-Lev when many people after the terrorist attack came out and blamed him for this terrorist attack and said that his words caused this. His words are bad. His words are condemnable, maybe, and he should resign for what he said there and for his beliefs on this matter. That being said, their blood is not on his hands. He said that a few days ago, and terrorist attacks, as we've said, have been a very common occurrence lately. And this happened to have been a more public one because it was a more successful one, sadly. But he does not bear the responsibility or the blood for this specific terrorist attack. He even immediately afterwards said that we will hunt down the terrorists that committed these actions. I am loath to defend him, but on this specific issue, he does deserve some defense.
So I disagree with a couple things that you were stating, especially when it comes to the level of the terrorist attack and the type of terrorist attack. This was an organized terror. It's a whole other ballpark than anything we've dealt with till now. This isn't someone who walked around the street, took his knife out, and decided to stab someone, as horrible as that is as well. These are people that waited for an ambush with weapons and shot over 16 bullets into this vehicle that was leaving this area. And that's what makes the situation scary, and that's what makes it more complicated. To your other comments when it was coming to what the government's supposed to do, this is always very complicated on what a government is supposed to do about, I guess you could call it single terror, even though in this situation it is not. This group organized itself together, which means that you can figure out with intelligence who this group was, where they came from. There is no scenario that I believe, or at least let's see it happen and let's figure out the truth. I don't believe that this is four guys that were sitting around having dinner and they're like, you know what? Let's go shoot some people. Took their guns, sat out, or waited for a car and shot them. It's usually not how it happens, and I would more believe that this is something that is more organized, and you have to understand where the source is. I'm not stating that this is something that goes all the way up to Hamas or the Rashut al-Falastin that sent this. It could be a lower-level gang, but this is a collection of people that made a decision to make an act. Now, when it comes to what the government could do, this, unfortunately, again, has a lot to do with what is happening in the public sector. You want to ask me? I think the solution is very simple to deter terror. We understand that terror, what time and time again, comes from hope. People thought and stated in the past that terror comes from despair and from fear. No, terror is coming from the hope that they can gain something from this. And that is the problem that you have to make clear. And you have to make clear that there is virtually only a downside to acting on terror. If it is deciding to say the next day, you know, you decide to shoot people in Chomesh because you think that's not supposed to be somewhere, good, we're going to settle it tomorrow. And this is not something, and then tell the entire world, well, guess what? People were randomly murdered there for being there, and that is your punishment. And if they understand that for every place that they deter terror, we will settle, this is something that will very, very quickly be deterred. And you know where we can see it. And we disagree with your statement about terror being year after year. No, terror was extremely, extremely lowered in the years of Trump's administration. When there was Trump's administration, BB, it was very, very clear. Terror was low everywhere. People were almost losing their jobs because there was no terror. Again, to be clear to those listening, there's always rock throwings and terrorist attacks that are low level, that unfortunately is always happening. But large successful terror, literally we went through the longest, an entire year, I believe it was the longest since the 2000s, this is the first Intifada, the longest entire year without a single person dead, citizen dead from terror attacks. And That is something that's absolutely incredible. And it came from the fact that they knew that if you would do a terrorist attack with Trump's administration, we would have 100% backing to do anything we feel right to do it. And in this situation, we're sitting here where both Bennett is in a predicament with his government and Biden's administration, which will not support us, and is showing that, you know what, this terror is going to happen. And unfortunately, I don't see any downside for the terrorists. Yes, they'll be caught, and they will be caught in the end, but there's nothing stopping the next people from doing it again, and that's, I think, the most dangerous part.
So I completely agree, but I would like to state, although it seems very strange to me to defend Omar Bar-Lev, who is, once again, a very vile human being who has terrible views on the politics of Israel and truly sees many of the settlers and the pioneers of this country as deplorables. Once again, it is not fair to blame it onto him. It is a general aspect of this government that they are weak on these issues. Once again, with Gantz meeting for a second time soon with Abu Mazen, who is the leader of the PA, and just their outlook on the Palestinian issue appears to have been not necessarily pushing to terrorism, but leaves an opening for them to rise up.
Okay, so I'm going to disagree with you on this. I 100% think it is Omar Bar-Lev's responsibility. Okay? Let me be clear. Responsibility is a political statement. He's not responsible. He doesn't need to go to jail tomorrow for this. But 100% he is responsible because your words have results. And they have consequences that you're responsible for. If you go to other acts, if someone came up and in one day decided that he's saying, you know what? People that really attack the gay community, you know what? It's because the gay community does things in your face. And then the next day someone goes out and murders a gay member on the street. That is the responsibility of that politician. That politician made that statement. You immediately have to be, I would say, fired, but have to be removed, because in any other context, we would do that. In this situation, it should be an uproar. And let me more than that.
I completely disagree. Because if you want to take just a view from American politics for a moment, and views that we happen to both disagree with and hate, if you take Bernie Sanders and the congressional baseball shooting, where he essentially said words about Republicans, and then one of his supporters went and shot up a baseball game. Sorry, that's not his responsibility. And I'm not discussing legally. Or when Obama said stuff about the police, and then you had a person get up and murder six police officers, a person who was very clearly a supporter of his because of his words. And I'm sorry, unless someone has a call to violence, and so unless someone does like something like that, even politically, it is not necessarily his fault, and I don't think it's fair to hold the actions of crazy people to the words of others. That being said, his words were different here, essentially, and they were fundamentally different. But it's not fair to place the blame of a terrorist attack at his feet.
There's a very big difference. I'm not talking about him getting fired. I'm not talking about a legal obligation. It is exactly where public outcry comes in. That is called politics. And you want to say bad time, you think you have responsibility for that. And I think that the outcry and the attacks on him should have been much, much fiercer. And he should understand that these words should never leave his mouth again. And if you know what, yeah. He should lose his job because the public says you can no longer continue in your service, because you know what? His job is the security of the citizens. That's his job. And that's where he failed on.
So I completely agree. And just to be clear on to the political aspect with the Biden administration, as you mentioned recently, we do have one piece of good news on this account. The push to open the Palestinian consulate in Jerusalem has reportedly been terminated. This is no longer on the agenda for this next term in the administration. Hopefully will not be beyond that as well. Credit where credit is due. This is mainly to the efforts of a few key members of the Knesset, one of them being Ner Barkat, who has flown to the United States on, I believe, already four occasions, and who has met with almost half the members of Congress and the Senate and many high-ranking officials in the State Department to plead the case of why it would be a very bad idea and why it would truly hurt Israel's interest in national security on this matter when it would on opening the consulate in Jerusalem.
I mean, yeah, I think it possibly could be a snowball effect of many good things. We'll have to wait and see. I think it shows that we were able to stand and make clear that we will not give in to that power. And I think that it shows again, it could backfire. We could realize that there was some backward deal that we don't know that we accepted for them not to push forward on it. But if it was a plain deal in which we're saying we are not going to accept the opening of that in our country and in Jerusalem, and therefore it was stopped, then that's a very good good point for the entire government as a whole, the entire Knesset.
So I don't really see it being such a snowball effect. I think this was truly a major push that was done and also had a lot of support from different members of the House and the Senate in the United States. It wasn't a very popular move in the United States as well, and therefore it seems to have gotten through. But once again, good news is good news. Now, on to a very different matter that we wanted to discuss this week. Officially, the law allowing police to have search and seizure of a home without the a warrant from a judge has passed the first stage. It is called Kriyah Rishona. Just a reminder as to how laws are passed in Israel. It must go through Kriyah Rishona, which is where it comes up to a vote for the first time in the Knesset. People approve the law. It goes to different committees. And depending on the exact law, it goes to a different committee for language to be formed for the law, except precise language. Then it is voted on a second time, a third time. And provisions are added and removed. Then it is put into the book of laws and then put into use in the country. Now, to be clear on to what this law means, it would mean that a police with legitimate concerns. What was legitimate concerns? Great question. We don't know. Neither do you. Legitimate concerns that there might be evidence that may or may not be tampered with in this household has the right to search any household without the approval of a court and without a warrant. Obviously, this is authoritarian and Orwellian garbage. This is complete government overreach that is disgusting and despicable. And the worst part, it is promoted by the right-wing members of this government. It is a law that is essentially meant to promote and to curb the violence in the Israeli Arab population, which has been rampant in the past few years and gotten into very, very bad levels. We consistently see on the news that another Arab was murdered. Arab-on-Arab violence has grown to massive proportions. Illegals, guns, and gangs, very big issues. That being said, this law is not a solution for that. Number one, these Arabs are citizens just like everyone else. They have rights. Number two, every law that you put into place to use against someone else will eventually be used against you. I see this so easily one day, especially with the police force being as terrible as it is in Israel. And we just mentioned Omer Bar-Lev, who is the Minister for Interior Defense, who is essentially the boss of the police, stating against the violence of settlers. I easily see him pushing the police to just do search of settlers' homes because there may be evidence that they might be conspiring to do acts of violence, that this evidence could disappear and be tampered with if they don't go and search right now, if they don't go waste the time and get a warrant. This is not acceptable law. This is not acceptable behaviors. People have rights in this country. This is a million steps too far that can never be allowed.
So I think this is, and I mentioned this a couple times, where like there's those red flags, there's those red lines that we seem to cross, that, you know what, to those listening to us could realize this, but some of the people in this country just don't even know that these things are happening. And they're really, really terrifying. This is one of them. This law, it's just the ignorance of how our government runs and how they pass laws. Time and time again, we pass laws to solve things on the short term, and we don't understand the long-term ramifications. This is how the entire Mapecha Mishpatit, the entire issue we have with the Supreme Court, started, on the same exact reasoning of allowing something that is needed, theoretically is a good reasoning for a short-term solution we need, and totally ignoring the long-term effects. And that is what's terrifying here, that the fact that this might help them stop the Arab violence that's happening, which is a great cause and very important, honestly, very important for the protection of the Arab lives. Those are the ones that need this to be able to help them stay safe and be safe in their homes and in their schools, which they are not, because the Arab and Arab terror is, the Arab and Arab violence is really horrific right now. But it's just, there's literally, like, even reading the way they wrote the law, they didn't even try to make it specific. You know, they weren't like, we have a specific issue, so we could say that we're passing a law that the search for illegal weapons that are by a that were probably sold by, you know, there's different things, then you could do a search. Even then I would say it's horrible, but at least you'd be specific. This is literally just saying that if the police force has the assumption and he could back up why he assumed that there was a danger, he doesn't have to wait for a warrant. And as you just mentioned, Yemen, that well, not even, it's not even far. I can't even say like years ahead. Within the next year, I can see that a policeman knocking on my door and saying, I have to enter in because I believe that there is drugs in your home with no evidence and no thing. But I heard you on the street saying something about drugs, which could be medicine for my wife or any other thing. And they could just knock down the door and say, we have to come in because we think there's danger in here.
And just like another issue, major issue that can arise from this that I happen to have just thought of is that, one, aside from the fact that all they need to say is that they have some rumor or they have an inkling that there may or may not be something illegal in the household, they can complete do a search of the household. I easily see this turning around and not just being used against Jews. This can be used since fruit of the poisonous tree is allowed in Israel. Well, even if we later claim that their search and seizure of the household was incorrect, any evidence that they may have found in the household of any illegal activities, or to prove, let's say they want to remove a parliamentarian who's running for office on the basis of racism, if they could find anything in his household that can be presented in his court, because they had now searched his household. And all of these issues are major issues that just basic rights of citizens trampled over and over again. And to really the main players and proponents of these laws, Bennett, Shaked, Kahana, all the members of Tikva Chadasha, Gidon Sar, how dare you do this? You ran on libertarian platforms, you ran on the rights of citizens, you ran on bringing back the basic rights of the people that were taken away from them, be it economically or socially. And you go around and do a law like this that's so blatantly on its face, beyond overreach and not within your realm of legality. And it just seems like, well, they already let us take some power, why not take it off? And just to go on to another authoritarian problem that has arisen is obviously the corona mandates. Most of you are aware, the Omicron variant has continued to spread throughout Israel and the world. And as a result, there have been many different restrictions that have been levied against the citizens of Israel. There were many different suggestions. The first one that was suggested and is considered actually been implemented to a very serious degree is obviously shutting travel. Planes will not be allowed to arrive in Israel. There was many countries that are restricted on red countries that are on no-fly lists, meaning even Israelis who want to go and come back and do quarantine cannot fly there. Most of the major countries of this world are on this list. The United States is set to be added to this list at the beginning of the coming week, meaning essentially all tourism and travel is dead. One of the major issues that has caused is the fact that the tourism part of the economy that has already been hurt to devastating manners this year will once again be hurt with absolutely no tourism allowed and with no compensation coming forward from the government. They even had the audacity to say, go find a different profession. Now, let me be clear. We happen to be as capitalist free market as it comes without government intervention. That being said, when a government goes and states that they would like the people to go find a different profession because that profession is not profitable, that's not a very fair statement when the government is the one who is making that profession not profitable, who is shutting down all markets, when they are not allowing any tourism or any thriving of these economies. And let me be clear, the tourism aspect of our economy doesn't affect just tourism. It affects many different aspects because, aside from the hotels, there's people who come to see different things, which support the communities in those areas, which is very important to the development of different communities and to building different parts of the country, which happen to have beautiful views or vistas or historical monuments, but onto their own can't sustain a community. You shut down complete communities and destroy lives of many of the citizens of Israel. Just terrible actions that are not necessarily going to help with any way with COVID, which, to be clear, Omicron is already here. By shutting down the airports, you're not stopping the variant from getting in. The variant is here, especially if you're requiring anyone to come on a plane to be third time vaccinated and to be tested and to wait 2-3 days and be tested again, which has its own set of epidemiological questions. None of this seems to make sense in any manner. And onto that not making any sense, there were a few other different restrictions that were placed on. The first of which was a restriction on the malls, which they wanted to place, which was stating that to get into a mall, you'd have to be with the Tav Hayaruk, which is stating that you have to be third time vaccinated, or the equivalent being a corona PCR test or other, or being already sick. And then they stated, well, that can't work because people have to get to basic things in the mall. So we're going to allow people go in for basic things. And anyone who's vaccinated walk around with a bracelet on their arms stating in the mall that's stating that they are vaccinated. But after severe backlash from the mall owners and from the store owners stating that they refuse, that they will not be the ones providing these bracelets, and nor will they be forcing anyone to wear them in the malls, because it will hurt their businesses too much and they also do not believe in it, the government walked back to their action. Now, the question arose from many of the reporters and from the people in the malls, if this was so important epidemiologically, how could you walk it back? And the answer that the government gave was, and this was an absurd answer given, this was reported by Israel Hayom, that it was not important epidemiology. They knew that it had no logic epidemiologically, but why did they do it? Because that they hoped that it would push people to go in and get vaccinated. Now, how dare they hurt the businesses of people in such a drastic manner and hurt the travel and the rights of the citizens in such a drastic manner in a way that they know has no epidemiological sense, just to go push people to get vaccinated, which unto itself, if people are vaccinated, doesn't give them their own rights back. It seems to be absurd.
So I think it's like it's a very complicated matter, and it's very strange the way the government is forming this. You know, we discussed, I believe it was 2 weeks ago when they started it, and we said, okay, they're going to do it for 10 days. It was very smart that they shut down so quickly. And then they said, but like, okay, let's start releasing, and then they didn't. And then they added 10 more days. And then we said, I guess they're waiting longer to get more information for 2 weeks. And then they added this entire, now they're shutting down basically most of the world for travel for Israelis. And the question to this comes is, you know, the one thing I want to come and say, it's interesting because COVID almost by definition is kind of a lose-lose situation. You don't do anything, a lot of people get sick, they blame you because you didn't do anything, you get sick. You do something, people don't get sick, they blame you because you're doing things and you're being impulsive, you're being pressured. Let's say the Omicron really does cause everyone to get sick. And you know, if we don't do anything, then technically I agree with them. Look, if they wait it out right now and they do exactly what we did with BB, we'd wait 2 more months, it would be fine. And in 2 more months, we'd have every single day 1,500 to 2,000 people that are sick every single day. We'd say, oh, look, it's a fifth wave. Oh, we got to shut it down. We're going to shut it down. Then it will take longer time to get rid of it. Where if we manage to push down and we push it away, then you won't have that problem. The question is how long? The question is what, like, do I think a fifth wave is going to come? Yeah, I think it's going to come anyway. Is it going to come now? Is it going to come in 2 months? Is it going to come in 4 months? That's a good question. Will we get vaccinated before or after? These are all plays that we're going to have to game. Will there be another round of people are going to get sick? I have no doubt that it's going to happen again, and it's just a matter of when. And that's why I think they're just taking a pretty extreme situation, and that's where I think that we're losing on is what is, like, the people are not understanding. So we can't find out because of what? The Omicron is already in Israel. Will it slow it down by shutting down the airports? For sure. No, for sure I believe it will slow down the process because there's just less points in which people are getting people sick. Will it stop the fifth wave from happening if it happens? I don't believe so.
So just to give a little data, because I think looking at numbers here is important. While we are not doctors and we don't happen to be experts in the medical field, just basic data can be read by anyone. And this is a report by the Washington Post that just pure numbers. Omicron appears to be currently 70 times as infectious as Delta, which is already twice as infectious as the original variant. Omicron is resulting in 10 and times 10 fewer hospitalization than prior waves in South Africa. South Africa being the origination of this variant happens to be the only one we can get long-term data currently. And already from that basic data, there's a lot that can be taken from that. Number one, yes, people are going to get sick because if it's not infectious, a lot more people are going to get sick. Number two, if it's that infectious and not that dangerous, and we know that at this point, does it require shutting down the country? Probably not, especially with the fact that Bennett's whole campaign platform was, I can beat corona, and how am I going to beat corona? I'm not going to get to zero corona because that's impossible. We're going to learn to live with corona. We're going to learn to live with COVID. And I think that's the point we have to get to, and that's the point we got to a while ago. And I don't think that if we just continue to shut down, and even if we say we're not doing a lockdown, he seems to practically be doing a lockdown consistently with all of these restrictions. How, when we had numbers low, did we not consider at any point removing the masks? How are we still walking around with masks consistently when they haven't done in a while any proven research onto why the masks were effective in the first place? Not that I'm denying the effectivity of masks or anything like that. That wasn't the point of what I was saying. It needs to be proven here. They need to come with data to the public if they want the public to trust them and to listen to any of their instructions anymore, especially with those that are not vaccinated. Because if you continue to restrict those that are vaccinated extensively, and you're going to require, and they've already discussed this on the news many times at this point in the past week, a fourth booster shot, well, a second booster shot, a fourth shot in general. And if you're already up to that point, I think it's going to be very, very difficult to convince any of the people who are not vaccinated to get vaccinated if you're not returning the rights back to those who are vaccinated. And I think we've gotten to the point where the government has to step back and say, we've done all we can. We've protected those who needed to be protected. We've given you there are vaccines. There are many therapeutics. And at this point, if you want to be extra careful, that is your right. That is your responsibility as an individual. And you have to make your own medical decisions. And this is no longer in our hands.
Okay, so I agree with a lot of what you're saying. But at the end, we have to realize that it is a variant of COVID. And it is spreading like wildfire in Europe. Many countries are shutting down. Holland is shutting down. Britain is planning very large steps to shut down there because they have thousands and thousands of people sick every single day. And we have to understand how to deal with it. My biggest issue is I just feel like there's dishonesty. And it was one of the things that I didn't feel until now. And that was what bothered me in the last government, which is stand in front of the camera and tell us what your plan is. And tell us
why
you're planning that. If we understand why, I can then disagree with you, but I can feel that I'm understanding what your goal is. And you're, by the way, your goal doesn't have to be fair. You can tell me straight up, my goal is to get more people vaccinated. But be open and honest in the first place so we can understand how to deal with it.
Yes, and I also think, as we mentioned numbers before, just because people are getting sick is not necessarily the issue. It can be an issue, whether it be long-term effects, which are, as we've stated before, is unclear at this point. But what it appears to be at the moment, if we're talking about hospitalization and death, as we mentioned, hospitalization time tends lower than any of the variants before. And on top of that, there is only one reported case as of yet of a person dying from Omicron with, as we mentioned, thousands of cases already in the world, many of thousands of cases of the world in the world. And that's very, very low numbers. It's not going to say that's not going to rise or that's not an issue, but those are just facts on the ground. And even though Bennett claimed this week that there were two children who died in Britain of Omicron, he later walked that back because he was wrong. But one reported case, that's it. That means that numbers aren't there to justify these actions, at least yet. And unless they have data that we don't, in which case, show it to us.
Okay, so goodbye to all of our listeners in the States. We'll hopefully see you in a couple months when they reopen up the borders and we can travel again. But for now, we'll move on to our next topic.
So, the appointment of the Attorney General, the Yoamash, is coming up. He is finishing his position in February. For those who are not aware, the Yoamash currently is Avichai Mendelblit. It's important to know a little bit about the history of the Yoamash before we get into the appointment. The Yoamash translates to the legal counsel. Now, I'm not meaning counsel as an attorney, but the legal counsel of the government. He is there to give legal aid and to answer questions of the government. He holds three major positions. He is in charge of all different cases in the country from the side of the government, as in when a court case says the people against X, he is the people, which gives him the power to intervene in any court case. Court systems decided that anyone can ask for a court case on any issue, he was allowed to intervene on any issue and ask for a court case. He is also in charge of indicting and investigating any of the appointed elected officials. He's the only one with this power. He's the only one who can indict a sitting prime minister. And, of course, to represent the government in court. Now, major issues have been caused in the past by this body, this person. he has said to hold too much power and contradicting power. The first major issue was caused by Alan Barak, who later, when he was in the position, who later went on to sit on the Supreme Court himself and to pretty much overthrow our entire judicial system. But just as to the point on the laws itself, one of the major issues is that they stipulated that a Yoamash, even though it says this nowhere in the law, his suggestions are mandatory. I.e., if you go to him for a legal suggestion and state, and he states, I'll tell you what, I don't think that this is that legal, or I think this has this and this legal issues, he can't later go and defend it in court with those legal issues in play. If he stated that he doesn't see it as a good law or it has legal issues, it cannot become a law. His suggestions are mandatory and must be followed. This is, again, without discussing the entire issues of indicting sitting prime ministers and sitting elected officials, which he investigates and indicts and has caused major corruption in the past, especially with the last two holders of that position. We could do an entire in-depth episode about the Yoamash and his different powers. The main point is he's getting re-elected. Well, not re-elected. He's getting a new appointment. The position is getting a new appointment in February. The current sitting one is getting removed from office. He cannot get elected again. He can get a temporary appointment until they find a replacement to continue his position, but he has already refused that offer. There are the members of this committee are made up of a member of the government, the Minister of Law, the Minister of Justice, a previous Minister of Justice, a no longer sitting Supreme Court Justice, a representative of the Lishkat Orchei Adin, which is pretty much the bar, so the equivalent of the Bar Association, and a representative of academia. Why these are representatives in the committee is a very good question, and it has to go, and it dates back to a issue with appointing with Bibi's first time appointing a Yoamash, where they because of legal issues they couldn't appoint a Yoamash. Really, a committee in the Knesset was formed to figure out what to do about it, and they came up with this committee. It is a mess of a process which should never have happened, but as it stands right now, they are discussing the different nominations and appointments of the Yoamash. As we've stated in the past, the current Minister of Justice hopes to split the power of the Yoamash into multiple positions. This is a very good move. It's with the amount of power he holds and with the fact that because of the way this committee is built, the Yoamash tends to lean heavily to the left ideologically on just judicial issues, especially with the fact that he holds so much sway in judicial matters, that when it comes to facing the courts, he must represent the ideals of the government. And we will continue to update as the different nominations go through, and we see more who will be the likely nominee.
So, you know, you basically summed it up. He has way too much power. He basically controls many decisions that affect every person's life in this country, and I sure hope that we end up successfully splitting his position into two different bodies that are in charge of two different roles that are both important but must be done separately.
And onto a completely different committee. So the Committee for Appointment of Dayanim. Dayanim is the heads of the religious courts in Israel. They are the ones who sit on the courts and adjudicate different cases in marriage law, essentially, and Giul and a few other issues. The committee for their appointment, to discuss their appointment, met this week. They have many different representatives from different aspects of the religious community. They have the head of the Minister of Religions and other members of the government attend. And as, of course, two sitting members on this committee that have voting rights on this committee are meant to be the Ashkenazi rabbi and the Sephardi rabbi, the Rishon LeZion. The Sephardi rabbi did not attend because he will not sit in the same room as the Minister of Religions. He requested to attend and vote via Zoom. It was denied to him by the Minister of Religions, smartly so, stating that if he wants to come, he's welcome to come. His seat will be saved. It will not be given away. But he cannot vote via Zoom, especially since considering the fact that Chavri Knesset, members of parliament, cannot come and vote even in their own committees via Zoom, so other people should not be able to. And aside from the fact that the actions of the chief rabbinate have been abhorrent, to say the least, and not necessarily respectable to the position he holds. He does happen to hold a very respectable position, and he needed to act more respectfully, especially in the case with which he disagrees. We discussed this in previous episodes extensively. And as a result, I think the Minister of Religions acted in a very appropriate manner. He was very respectful in the way he did it, but he was also very firm in his beliefs. And he later went on to have a big event in the Knesset this week. He went and gave a speech attacking essentially the Haredi factions in the Knesset. We happen to usually not discuss such religious issues on the podcast, but this is a very important one because it's a tear in what would be different allies in a different constellation of a government. Aside from the fact that most people on the right and the Haredis completely disagree on economic issues, they supposedly agree on religious issues. But Kahana, who is the Minister of Religions, opens this up to be a very clear slap in the face to that idea, for the very basic reason that when he goes up to state there, he says that the Haredis don't hate him. They do hate him, but they're not hating him because of him. They hate him because of who he represents, because of the ideological views he represents and the different schools of thought and religion that he represents. The different Batei Midrash, Beit Otniel, or the Gush, or other places like that, which he represents in their ideals, and those rabbis, that they don't respect his rabbis, and they don't respect his community that voted him in, and therefore they don't respect him. And he said it was the same thing about other members of his community that are not members of this government, be it Smutlitz or other people, that the Haredis hate them just as much as they hate him. And I think he was very right on this matter. And this is not just a political matter, but a cultural one that in the long term will have very strong effects on whether or not these people can work in a government in the future together, or even not these people, but their successors, because that they truly have glaring ideological differences. Like we mentioned at the beginning of the podcast with Omer Bar-Lev and others, these ideological differences are vast. Maybe not as vast as those, but they're vast and they're fundamental to the beliefs and livelihoods of different people in this country.
So I think that a slight add-on is really we have to understand that in the end, the Haredi world is strongly embraced in the cautious world, and that results in hundreds of jobs for people in the Haredi community. Now, I want to take a little bit of a different spin on it, and let's not say it from the, you know, take out the people on top that I think are really genuinely corrupt, and I think they do things in a corrupt way. But if you go a little more on the ground level, you're just talking about hundreds of people that are, you know, mashgichei kashrut. They go to stores and they check that they're kosher and they go through. And from their perspective, all these people are going to lose their jobs. And this is what makes them terrified, and this is what makes them so blindly attacking it. So, like, I want you to imagine this for a second. Let me give you an analogy. Imagine that the head of transportation is also the head of all taxi drivers. Now, another minister comes in and says, let's bring a better option like Uber. And we come and say, this will be cheaper, it's better for the citizens, it will save everyone money. But then the head of the public transportation, on the one hand, you'd say his real job is to have the best public transportation for his citizens. So obviously he should be supporting Uber. But on the other hand, he is in charge of all taxi drivers. So he, even though it's a good law for him, it's a good idea, he is going to do everything to go against it because he's in charge of those taxi drivers. It's the same situation here. The head rabbinate, which technically is in charge of rabbinical religious ideas in the country, which means that let's say he's in charge of kashrus, and he's in charge of making sure that food is kosher. That's his job. But also, he is in charge of all people that work in the rabbinate and the kashrus, which means that he's responsible for all of their jobs. And therefore, no matter if the law is good and it's supposed to push better kashrus and save money for the citizens, they are obviously going to be against it. And that's where I think that they're being dishonest to their people and to their jobs by stating that this is not good for Kashrus and this will attack Kashrus, even though it's really just protecting the people's jobs.
So I agree. It's obviously more complicated than this, and sadly, Matan Kahana is probably going to lose this fight for the basic reason that the Haredis are, albeit the best politicians in this country, have been in the power the longest and know how to play the game quite well. But we have to move on, and our next discussion is a little bit is something we discussed last week, which we have more insight to and a few corrections to make. We might get into the moral debate on the specificities of the law on a different time. We would just like to make a few corrections about the current state of affairs regarding abortion and the future regulations that are to be put into place. So first, the current state of affairs regarding abortion is that a woman who seeks an abortion must go through a committee of approval who has five different options to approve an abortion for her.
Those five being: one, if it is in danger to her or to the fetus; two, if she's above the age of 40; three, if she is a minor; four, if she is out of wedlock; and five, if the pregnancy was as a result of rape. And the only possibility for women, for married women that are under the age of 40, is if they got pregnant as a result of cheating.
So, again, we're not going to delve into the exact moral issues onto this matter, but the committees have, by their own admission, lied on many occasions, just stating that the pregnancy was due to infidelity outside of the marriage, and therefore allowed the woman to terminate the pregnancy. Whilst this is important, not going to discuss that. Now, onto the exact specificities of the new regulation put into place. Well, going to be put into place, actually. This is according to Channel 12 News. It states that it will be up until 12 weeks, anyone who seeks can get an abortion. Up until 24 weeks, a committee will be there to advise the woman. The woman will have to go through an advisory committee, not an approval committee. It does not state what type of committee, but one can assume that it will be one like exists at the moment, which is a professional committee. And after that, after 24 weeks, a woman seeking to terminate the pregnancy at that point after 24 weeks will have to go through a committee to approve such a process. We will delve into in the future to the moral debates and arguments surrounding this issue and this specific law in the future. But let's move on to our final segment for the day.
Dumb Economics of the Week.
So, the Minister for Energy has stated that she is closing the seas for search for natural gas after serious backlash, and we'll explain the backlash in a moment. She has stated that she will be closing this only for a year.
Now, her defense for this was she said that she's closing this because of green energy. She wants to prove that we are serious about it. Now, there are so many issues with this statement. First of all, gas replaces coal, which is way worse for the environment. So us moving to gas would actually be better. You know, we know that natural gas can replace two coal factories or be sold to developing countries as a fuel source which is less polluting than the fuel source they use currently. Also, showing that we are serious is a pretty dumb reason. That doesn't push us forward except for us making us look good for the public eye. A third other reason is that in the end, where currently the energy is being created anyway, there is a massive energy crisis around the world. Us deciding to stop searching for energy is just putting us behind and putting us not be able to be part of this and being able to show us. We will be the only country in the entire world that does this. And therefore, instead of us being able to profit and push forward positive energy, we're kind of just doing it from a negative perspective and losing at the same time. And with that, we will conclude this week's episode. We thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed. We remind you to share us on social media. Check out our new series, Quick Recap, in which we recap all of the political events in under 5 minutes. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next week. This is Here We Go Again.